What's This American Life? I'm Ira Glass. Each week on our show, of course, we choose a theme and bring you different kinds of stories on that theme. Today's show, No Map. Stories of people struggling through situations where there are no guideposts or precedents. We've arrived at Act Two of our show. Act Two, where's King Solomon when you need him? It's not like there's not a map for how to handle being a parent. Our culture is actually awash with how-to parenting guides. It's actually kind of comforting. If any jackass can have a kid, I can have a kid. Anything that comes up, somebody has already dealt with. You'll be able to get advice. Unless you're the guy in this next story, Mike Nyberg. Over the course of 4 years, he got into a series of situations and faced a series of parenting decisions in adopting a child that were so unusual, so difficult. It really seems that he was lost at sea in almost uncharted parenting territory. Ted Gessing tells us what happened.
Mike and Carrie Nyberg already had two sons. They're Mormon, or LDS, Latter-day Saint. And when they decided to adopt, they began to look at children from Samoa, a small Pacific island that has a large LDS population. Mike remembers the first picture he saw of the three-year-old they would eventually name Aaliyah.
I saw a cute little girl with a pair of pants that seemed to be cut off at about the knees. She didn't have a shirt on. Her bangs were trimmed really short, looked like kind of a hack job.
What was your understanding of these kids' situations? Did they have families or no?
We were told that they did have families and that their families were giving them up because of their financial circumstance, that they wanted a better life for their child. They were not able to provide food for their children.
Aaliyah was the youngest of eight kids. The adoption agency Mike and Carrie chose in Salt Lake City, called Focus on Children, told them that Aaliyah had been living for the past 9 months in the agency's nanny house, where a Samoan couple took care of the children. But when the time came for them to go pick her up, Mike and Carrie were told that Samoa and the nanny house were off limits because of a recent hurricane. They would have to meet the girl at the closest major airport in New Zealand. They flew there and waited for Aaliyah's flight.
We picked Aaliyah up at the airport at 1 o'clock in the morning, and you know, we waited and waited. Everybody came off the airplane, and finally, here came this little girl in a little blue dress, little straps on the shoulders, and she was holding a little orange basketball. And she just looked so sad. But we were so excited. I had the camcorder going, and she kept repeating the words, Fialu Atupu. Not knowing Samoan, not knowing any Samoan at all, we had no idea what she was saying, couldn't communicate with her.
They took her back to their hotel and did what the adoption agency had instructed them, which was to rub her down with a lotion that would kill off scabies.
So here we have this little girl who hasn't reached her fourth birthday quite yet, and these two white people, we've stripped her down to nothing, and we're rubbing this lotion all over her body, into her hair, into her scalp. And she's just scared to death. And I never forget sitting in that love seat and rocking her while she said that, Pialu Atupu, not knowing what she was saying as she finally fell asleep. So our goal the following day was to go out and find somebody that spoke Samoan. We finally found out that one of the waiters in the restaurant in the hotel we were staying was from Samoa, and so he talked to her a little bit, and he proceeded to tell us that Fialu Atupu means I want Tupu. Tupu was her mother. And so, you know, she was merely saying, I want my mom, and who wouldn't? You know, she would hold my hand and as we walked down the street, but I think she really felt like what we were going to do is we were going to take her back where she came from, because she always wanted to go. She would actually pick up that little basketball that she had, and she would walk over and squat down next to the door and just wait like we were getting ready to leave.
Within days, they were back in Utah, and Aaliyah began to settle into her new life. She was doing well, Mike said, and she picked up English incredibly quickly. It only took her about a month. And that's when things began to change for the Nybergs.
She started to tell us about her parents, and she would name them, and she would talk about these different names. And so we wrote all these names down that she would say and tried to spell them the best we knew how. Well, come to find out, these were her siblings and her parents that were sleeping together on the floor of the folly. Folly is a word for house. So immediately when she starts talking about sleeping with her family on the floor in the folly, we had the question come up, well, why would a little girl who was supposed to have been in foster care in the nanny house for almost 9 months prior to us adopting her, that would put her just barely over 3 years old, why would she be still talking about her parents? Why wouldn't she be referring to the nanny and the nanny's husband?
There were other clues that something wasn't right. They dug up a photo the adoption agency had sent, supposedly taken of Aaliyah at the nanny house, and discovered it didn't match the photos of the nanny house that were on the internet. Mike and Carrie were realizing they'd been lied to in little ways, and they wondered if they were being lied to in big ways. So they started digging around. A friend's brother-in-law was working with the LDS Church in Samoa and agreed to help them. He got a translator and tried to track down Aaliyah's birth parents, the Sows, in the remote jungle village listed on Aaliyah's birth certificate. They headed out past where maps could take them and eventually found some of Aaliyah's relatives. Not Tupu, her mother, but Ama, Aaliyah's oldest sister, and her husband Tovia, who spoke English. Tovia explained that the girl had always lived with them, not in a nanny house, and that the So family had a very different understanding of what they had signed their girl up for. It was this.
Aaliyah was going to be here in the United States until she was 18 years old. She would be getting an American education, and that we, the American family, were supposed to be sending money to the birth family during that time span while she's here in the United States. Then when she turned 18, of course, she would return to Samoa with that education and be able to support the family or whatever they saw fit.
The Sows seemed to believe this was a study abroad program and that they'd be receiving updates, photos, letters, and gifts. Of course, this was not at all what the adoption agency had told Mike and Carrie, which is that this girl was left at a nanny house 9 months earlier by a family that couldn't afford to feed her, and that it was a traditional closed adoption where the birth family would have no claim to their child. The Sows, it turned out, were farmers with plenty to eat and more to sell at market. And worst of all was the story of the Sows' last interaction with their daughter. Someone from the adoption agency came by one evening to get the girl and told the Sows that she was just spending a night in the nanny house to get used to being away from home. The man told them Aaliyah would be back the next day. Instead, that same night, she was taken straight to the airport and put on a flight to New Zealand.
So we were getting this little girl, unbeknownst to us, that had been with her parents 2 hours earlier, not knowing that they were fully planning on seeing her the next day, but never to see her again. And once they figured out she wasn't coming back, imagine how terrified they were.
To understand why the Sows would even agree in the first place to a deal like the one they described, it helps to know that in Samoa, there's no tradition of relinquishing your legal rights to a child. There are no orphanages there. There's no such thing as adoption. Samoans generally have large families, and it's not unusual to send a child for a time to other family members or friends who can better afford to raise him or her. To them, it just becomes an extended family. So to the Sows, the idea of sending a child off to be taken care of and educated in the U.S. didn't seem all that odd. After hearing all of this from their man in Samoa, the Nybergs took a huge step. They went to the authorities. They told what they'd found to the State Department agent, who had processed their application to adopt, and to an agent from Immigration and Customs. Both agents were shocked. Mike and Carrie knew that the case would escalate, but they had no idea what would happen to their family. They'd had Aaliyah for almost 6 months. Did you think about whether you would have to give her back at that stage?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I thought, well, if this adoption isn't supposed to be, then, you know, is this child really ours? Whose family does she belong to? It was scary.
What did this do to your relationship with Aaliyah herself? How do you react to that?
Well, I didn't allow it to, and not that I was consciously making a choice. I continued to bond with her. I treated her normally. I think my wife kind of went the other direction. She probably had some concerns, and so I think she kind of became standoffish, knowing that maybe this adoption is fraudulent and we won't get to keep this little girl. How can I let myself get attached to her?
Carrie didn't want to speak to us for this story. She did send me an email answering some of my questions, but didn't address this particular point. So we only have Mike's perspective on this. The government started its investigation, interviewing dozens of families in America and in Samoa. And for a long time, there was nothing Mike and Carrie could do except wait. Finally, they decided to fly to Samoa themselves, with Aaliyah, to meet her family, the Sows. At this point, Mike and Carrie had been raising Aaliyah as their daughter for almost 2 years. The two families arranged to meet at an LDS temple in Apia, the capital. Aaliyah recognized her parents immediately, and they picked her up and hugged her and cried. You're all standing there meeting for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's immediate, it's apparent that that this is their girl and she wants to be with them?
No, not necessarily. It's a very strange situation because she was hesitant going to them because she'd been away from them for a while. She really didn't want to stay with them. Right after that, we loaded up into a vehicle and headed to their village and spent time out there. And it took her time to readjust back into her family. You know, they very much loved their daughter. You could absolutely tell. But she was really bonded to me, and when I was there, she didn't seem to want anything to do with anybody else. Wanted to kind of sit on Daddy's lap. And, you know, seeing where she was from, you come around a corner and you see this a building with, you know, palm leaves on the roof and no outside walls, just poles holding the roof up, and then to start looking around and see how dirty it is, how filthy the kids' clothes were that lived there, just living amidst all the mud and dirt and lava rock. And we all sit on the floor. Everybody pretty much sits in a big circle. The kids kind of run around. They have one little light bulb, about a 60-watt light bulb that's in the ceiling there, and that's their light.
It was hard to communicate. More than just a language barrier, there was a cultural barrier. It wasn't clear what to talk about. Mike says they didn't seem to want to discuss what had happened or why it happened. All they really wanted to know was what would happen next.
You know, initially, that's the first thing they ask is, okay, what's the program? And that was their way of asking us, why are you here? What are we doing? Is Aaliyah coming back to live with us? Or is she going back home with you? They know that we love her, and they know that we are taking care of her, and they can see that she's in good hands, and they appreciate that, and they want us to make the decision. You know, it wasn't up to them. It was up to us to decide what to do.
It was dark when Mike and Carrie left the village to drive back to their hotel. In the car, they struggled to figure out what would be best.
We're talking about a human life, a little girl, and to treat it like it's a box of bananas seemed unreasonable and unfathomable to me, because now I have to decide what to do with her, and I love her to death. She was just like my own flesh and blood. But it also gave me a taste of how her own parents really felt, not having her and not being able to be with her. I think I felt the same love they felt for their daughter.
When I asked Carrie about this in an email, she said she also felt for Aaliyah's parents. She'd lost a child, a 2-month-old, and she said knowing there was another mother out there who lost her child broke her heart. There was no way I would put another mother through that pain, she wrote. Mike and Carrie decided to leave Aaliyah with her birth family. It's a decision Mike describes as the right one, but he still plays it over and over in his mind. His biggest consideration, he says, was his wife's relationship with Aaliyah.
Let's put it this way, Ted. If it was just me that had made that choice, there's a lot higher possibility that she wouldn't have stayed there. Maybe because I'm selfish, I don't know. You know, maybe it's a little strong to say that I would definitely have not left her there, but I think I wanted Aaliyah a little bit more than what my wife did. The fact that she hadn't bonded with Aaliyah, you know, it wasn't as difficult for her to make that choice. But as a couple, you decide what would be best for the entire situation.
In the end, Mike took comfort in the only thing that seemed like solid footing, the idea that he could remedy an injustice by returning Aaliyah.
The middle ground that I kept standing on was that she was given to us on false pretenses. And we were lied to. They were lied to. Maybe she just isn't supposed to be with us.
Did you worry that Aaliyah would suffer? Did you feel like you were abandoning her in any way?
I absolutely did. The night that we left, we were getting ready to go to the airport, staying in the village, and I could not peel her off of me. She was crying, and we were talking to her, trying to let her know that it would all be okay and that she was going to be able to stay with Tupu and Isaya. And she just bawled and bawled, and she clung to my neck and would not let go. And her mom tried to take her, and her mom couldn't get her off of me. Her dad couldn't get her off of me. And finally, her brother, he was able to peel her off my neck. We found out that she, you know, cried herself to sleep for several weeks after that.
Mike and Carrie returned to Utah alone. Mike says the house was strange without her. They'd kept her room the same, her girly bed, some clothes that no longer fit. Her little bike was still in the garage. Every couple of weeks, they would call Samoa just to check in.
And that went on for, oh gosh, it'd been about 5-6 months. And they had the ability to call us from their cell phones also. And they called us one day and they said, you know, we know that you love Aaliyah. And if you would like to have her back, you can have her.
For weeks, I called the Sos to hear their side of this, but it always went straight to voicemail. The one time I did get through, I spoke with Aaliyah's sister-in-law, who said they didn't have any minutes on their phone card and couldn't talk. If it seems hard to believe that they'd give Aaliyah back again, Mike says it's really pretty straightforward. He believes the Sos had come to trust him and Carrie, and now thought of them as extended family. And her parents knew if they sent Aaliyah back, she'd have all the advantages they wanted for her in America. And they'd still get to see her and be part of her life.
You know, they could feel it. They knew that she was in a good situation, probably the situation that they had dreamed for her. Honestly, for me, I felt joy. I thought, really? Okay. You know, kind of a, well, that's neat.
Did you think that Aaliyah had been unhappy there and wanted to come back or would benefit from coming back?
Well, I knew that she had been unhappy in the initial month because of, you know, hearing about how she cried herself to sleep every night. And, you know, of course, I was very concerned about that. Very concerned that, you know, maybe having gone through as much as she's gone through, it was detrimental to her mental and spiritual well-being. And now I can kind of keep an eye on her and I can make sure she's provided for and I don't have to wonder how she's doing.
They went back to Samoa to pick up Aaliyah.
You know, that week in Samoa was a wonderful reunion for everybody. We made sure that most of her family was able to go to the airport to see her off. And when we went to get on the airplane, some of her family were in tears, but she wasn't in tears, and she wasn't fighting to stay with them. I think more Aaliyah is resolved to, oh, well, this is just the way life is. This is what I do. I go back and forth.
Back in Utah, Aaliyah was soon at home again, sleeping in her old room, playing with her two brothers. She started up school in the fall. And Mike said he was so hopeful about the whole thing that his wife would come to feel as close to Aaliyah as he did. But things didn't really improve.
In June was when she came back. In October, my wife asked me for a divorce.
The past 3.5 years had been rough on Mike and Carrie's marriage. The stress of adopting and then giving Aaliyah back was huge in itself. But on top of that was the investigation into the adoption agency, focused on children. The Nybergs were in constant contact with various law enforcement agencies. The case had sort of taken over their lives. It was exhausting. The day after they decided to split up, Mike called the Sows to let them know. Now he was asking them what they wanted to do. Leave Aaliyah with him or take her back?
Well, I knew full well that their idea for their daughter was to be here with an LDS family in the United States. But the key word there is family, and an operative family where there's a mother and a father, not a divorce situation. So I called them the next day, the Sows, and presented to them what was happening and asked them what they would like to do. And they chose to have Aaliyah come back to Samoa.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did, they said, if you and Carrie ever get back together again, you can have Aaliyah again.
What did you tell her, Aaliyah?
You know, just told her that she was going to go back to live with her family in Samoa. And, you know, there's not, at that age, it's hard to, you know, you can't really tell her a whole lot. We certainly didn't tell her we were getting divorced. And I'm not sure that Aaliyah knows why she was going back and forth. So we got to the airport and put her on an Air New Zealand flight that goes straight to Apia, Samoa. Wow. You know, I'll never forget that day. And I really didn't feel comfortable with it. they came to, you know, they called her name. And, you know, they usually let the children on first, and they came to get her. And, you know, so we walked her right to the ramp, and she held the lady's hand and walked down the ramp and got on the plane, and that's the last we saw of her at that point.
Mike still wonders about all of this, every step. And when he does, he comes back to this weird balance, where he believes he did the right thing, but he can't exactly explain why it was right, even to himself.
I know a lot of this probably is hard to understand. Every decision I made in this process was through prayer, and I can't explain to you why I received the answers that I did, but I can tell you that now, sometimes the answers don't seem reasonable, or they just don't make sense.
After more than 3 years of remarkable efforts, I am pleased to be here to discuss what I refer to as the thoughtful resolution of the most difficult and unique case that we've seen in this office in a long time. In resolving this case with guilty
pleas... On February 25th, Brett Tolman, the U.S. Attorney for Utah, spoke to the press about the sentencing of the owners and staff of the adoption agency Focus on Children. 2 years earlier, he had filed his indictment, 135 counts involving 37 families. But in the end, owners Scott and Karen Banks pled guilty to much reduced charges. They admitted to some false statements made in the adoption paperwork, but not a lot more. They didn't admit to intentional deception or fraud. The judge required them to pay into a fund for counseling for some of the children and to help the U.S. and Samoan families keep in touch, although the court isn't forcing the U.S. families to initiate contact. Most important, the judge banned Scott and Karen Banks and all their employees from the adoption business for life. International adoption fraud cases like this have almost never made it into U.S. courts. There's only been one other instance so far. So adoption advocates all over the country were watching closely. And when they heard the plea deal, no jail time, not even probation, they were outraged. Tolman knew this and wearily explained why the case ended as it did. He clearly had struggled, just like Mike Nyberg, to make sense of the whole thing.
We do not pretend, I do not pretend, to have the perfect answer or the perfect approach. At the heart of this case has always been the children. When the choice became the welfare, future, and lives of the children versus the amount of jail time and sheer punishment of the defendants, I chose the children and avoiding further innocence from suffering.
What that meant in practice was that Tolman and his team didn't want to drag the adoptive families through a trial, which many of the families feared could attract too much attention from the Samoan government or Immigration and Customs, anyone who might question their right to keep their adopted children. There could still be civil suits, a custody fight. At least one Samoan father is actively trying to get his child back, but that's unusual. Prosecutors say that most of the Samoan families are not seeking their children's return. In interviews, they told investigators they just wanted to make sure their kids were safe. They wanted to do what's best for them. And none of the other American families involved wanted to do what the Nybergs did, return their children to Samoa. As the prosecution team realized this, the meaning of justice in this case changed. Jonathan Lines handled the case for Immigration and Customs. He said a couple of his investigators were unusually disturbed by what they learned. As parents, they couldn't quite draw enough distance. And by now, neither Lines nor anyone else is prepared to argue that the kids should be returned to Samoa.
The only perspective I can give you is from my own human perspective. I don't know that I could give a child back. This is an absolute conundrum, and it's something that I don't know will be easily resolved. That's why this the investigation and a resolution that would seek real and true justice, I don't know that that's ever possible in a scenario like this.
As for the other families in this case, most of them say they wish Mike had never gone to the feds at all, that there'd never been an indictment. They've been angry with Mike, and they thought he was crazy to give back his daughter. Rod Young was one of three parents who spoke at the sentencing. He testified in defense of Focus on Children, who brought him his son, Tani. Rod loves Tani so much he gets choked up just talking about him. And he makes the same argument the Bankses themselves made in their own defense. They did so much good in adoptions worldwide. They brought so much aid to poor communities. Plus, these kids are better off here. And if the Banks has cut a few corners in their business, that's only a tiny part of the whole picture. I spoke to Rod Young right after the sentencing.
I don't know if you heard, but they've done over 1,000 adoptions. And today's event was focused on 39 of them, of which we only heard from two that were really, really angry, and I believe that those were the ones that started the whole thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with our adoption.
Do you feel that this case puts your family at risk?
It potentially, that's the biggest fear. And hopefully today what I was able to do a little bit and what I said was, in speaking out, was to say, hey, look, I mean, these children are here. They're already so much more advantaged by 1,000% from where they come from. And we love the Samoan culture. But if I had if I had a nickel for every person that touched my son and said, lucky baby, just to reach out and touch him as we were going through the markets, the people that would take him and hold him and say, lucky baby, and then give him back to us because they know what he was coming back to as opposed to what was there. Now, it's a wonderful life, but there's nothing there for the children.
Mike Nyberg can understand why other parents haven't done what he did. He gets that his extraordinary decision might never be repeated by other families.
Why don't they want to give the children back if you did and you knew it was the right thing? Or are all these people not doing the right thing?
I can't speak for them. I know how I feel about Aaliyah, and I know how difficult it is, and I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. It is a decision that is nobody should ever have to make. So these are questions that nobody's ever had to answer before. And there are no answers to those questions of who, what's right and what's wrong. Because if they send all the kids back to Samoa, you're doing essentially the same thing that happened to those children to begin with, ripping them out of their homes. But do they really belong to these families? That's God's call. But you know what? I don't think he's going to tell us. I think we just have to make the right choice.
Since February 2007, when Mike and Carrie said goodbye to Aaliyah at the airport, Mike has gone back to Samoa once for a visit. He brought his two sons so they could really see where she was. Mike said they never understood it before, just looking at the globe, at a tiny dot in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Mike's dream is to one day have enough money to bring Aaliyah over here for extended visits, every year or two. And in Samoa, not too long after Aaliyah's return, one of her older sisters had a baby boy. She named him Mike. A few months after that, another sister gave birth to another boy. They named this one Nyberg.
Ted Gessing is a TV documentary producer.
I got to make it right for everyone concerned. What's getting burned? 'Cause I could never make you unhappy. No, I couldn't do that, girl. Only wish I didn't love you so.
Our program is produced today by Jane Feltus and me, with Alex Blumberg, Sarah Koenig, Lisa Pollock, Robin Semien, Alyssa Shipp, and Nancy Updike. Our senior producers, Julie Snyder, production help from Andy Dixon. Seth Lind is our production manager. Music help from Jessica Hopper. This American Life is distributed by Public Radio International. WBEZ management oversight for our program by our boss, Mr. Tori Malatia, who warned me, do not hire a chimp to mix the credits.
A chimpanzee can tear a man apart with his bare hands.
I'm Ira Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.
I can't blame you for what you're doing to me, girl. Even though
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next week, here on the podcast of This American Life.
At one point, some folks I was working with were trying to get me to get a group of people together to rob an armored car for the revolution.
That's right. The revolution. Some people still believe in it. A former anarchist explains why he crossed over. That's next week on the podcast or on your local public radio station. From Public Radio International.